Luke chapter 22, verses 39 through 43. And it reads as follows. Coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives, as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone throw. And he knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him.
Well, good to see everyone who's out this morning, and obviously the weather has not been the greatest the last few days. May not be for a couple more days coming, but we're thankful that everyone who was able has made the effort and is here this morning. We have a good number present, considering the circumstances, but we're glad you're here, and I hope as we look at this lesson this morning, everything in the service thus far has kind of coincided to prep us what we're going to talk about in the lesson this morning, and we'll get more into that in just a moment. I do want to make one additional announcement. Ethan came to me and said that one of his friends, by the name of Cody, he suddenly lost his mother during the night, and so she passed away apparently. So let's remember them, those children, and that family. Obviously, I'm sure probably none of us here except for his family know them, but nonetheless, we can identify with that kind of thing, so let's remember them in our prayers. A lot of the things Tom was saying before the Lord's Supper will kind of take off from that. This morning, I want us to look at Jesus in the garden, and in particular, I want us to look at the suffering of Jesus. Come on. There we go. I want us to look at the suffering of Jesus, and not so much as Tom was saying, not the normal things we think of. We think of the beating, we think of the crucifixion, we try in numerous ways to describe that. But I want us to talk about this particular part of the night of the betrayal and some of the most difficult time, obviously so, especially from Luke's account, that Jesus went through. Maybe this was the worst emotional time of his life. Now we probably can, to some degree, identify with a very intense situation when we've suffered, and that might be different things for different people. It can be some news that you get. It can be a situation like Ethan's young friend or whatever it might be. But emotionally, the impact it has upon us, and this was the case for Jesus when the moment, or sometimes as is described in the Gospels, the hour came. Jesus had come to earth for this very time. He knew that. And all his life, he would have lived with the thought that this time was going to come. Now, far beyond any of us. I mean, we sort of live with that. We know that we will get older, and if all things being natural and normal, we will age and we will eventually die. We live with that. And as sometimes we talk about, we kind of put it out of our minds, or we don't like to dwell on it. We don't like to think about it. Sometimes we do think about it very seriously, but it's always there. For Jesus, it would have been far more intense. He would have known to the smallest degree everything. And he would have known exactly when this time was. And so the hour came. He talked about it the nearer he came to it. But finally, on the night of the betrayal, it's time. And when you listen to some of the things that are said here by Jesus, and you realize what he's doing, I think you begin to get that idea of the suffering beyond the crucifixion, the kinds of things that Jesus suffered. I agree with what he was saying with Peter there and the denial and those kinds of things. This was one of those situations. He took his disciples to a favorite place. Notice from the reading that was just done a moment ago, as he was wont to do, or it was his custom to do. This apparently was a favorite place. Maybe during this week, he had come there each day following the time in the temple and so forth. But it was a favorite place for them to go. It was a garden area. No one knows archaeologically. We don't know exactly where it was on the Mount of Olives, but we do know it was there. And we know it was near the Brook of Kidron, John 18. But it was a favorite place, a garden spot, and it was somewhere where Jesus went to pray, to commune with God. And if you look at this account in Luke 22, and you may want to just turn there, and it starts in verse 39, it says, he came to this place, as he was wont, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. He takes them there. And then he will, of course, separate from them. And in fact, what's going to happen is he will pray. He was very emotional. He was in extreme sorrow. And the Bible uses numerous phrases. These songs that Edward led, and I really appreciate those songs, they poetically describe a time of intense anguish. He was very emotional. The Bible says he was in extreme sorrow. He wanted the cup, and of course it's the cup of suffering. He wanted that to pass from him. He prays to God about that, if it's possible. He acknowledges to God, all things are possible for you. If it's possible, let this cup of suffering pass from me. He wanted his friends to comfort him. And you probably, and you know, a few people in this world, when things are at their worst, they just want to be alone. Leave me alone. I want to be by myself. But most people really want others to be with them. If you've gotten some terrible news, if you've lost a loved one, whatever it might be, you want your friends. You want your closest people to you. And the very word friend intimates someone who loves you and loves you passionately. You want those closest to you to comfort him. He wanted his friends to comfort him, to be with him, as we say. You know, as long as I can just have so-and-so with me, I can handle such and such. He wanted them with him as he prayed about this, all of this that he had to go through. And I might even say that you can hear it in what he said to the disciples. The spirit is willing, the flesh is indeed weak. I often wonder if that was a reflection of what he was feeling. His divine spirit was willing to do this. He left heaven to come to earth to die for us. He knew that. He had known that before the world was ever created, he was going to do that. The Bible teaches us the Lamb was slain before the foundation of the world. He came to do that. His divine spirit was perfectly willing to do that. But now he's human. He also is completely, absolutely human, just like you. And the human flesh doesn't want to do it. And you know how that is. I mean, sometimes we have to do things we don't want to do. We'd rather almost do anything than do what we've got to do. We know we have to, but we don't want to. And I think you can hear that in what Jesus is saying. I'm willing, but I'd not like to do it, and if it's possible, I don't want to do it. We see all of that as he's praying in the garden. And I think a lot of people find it easy. When you look at this picture, you know, there are a lot of times when it's hard to identify with Jesus. If you ask me, can you identify with Jesus hanging on a cross, dying for the sins of everyone else, not your own, I really can't. I can talk about it academically, but I can't identify with that. If you ask me, can you identify with Jesus in the garden, praying and begging God that the suffering pass from him, that he not have to go through it? I can identify with that. And you probably can too. There have been times when I knew that I was going to have to face some very, very difficult thing, and I begged God that it not be so. If there was any way that God could to change it, and God could not. It had to happen as it did. Now, I'm not going to go into some of those times, but I can identify with that, and I'm sure you probably can too. And many find it easy to identify with him because you see a most human side of him here in the garden. Now, let's start by noting the disciples. He took the 12 with him. They followed him. Remember the events of the night. They get up from the Lord's Supper, as Tom was talking about. They go out into the night. Jesus has a lot to say to them and does. And then he starts for this garden. I'm sure they knew where he was going. They had been there before. And as they follow him, they realize, oh, he's going to the garden spot. He takes the 12 with him. And they were to sit. The only thing he really says to the 12 as a group is, sit here while I go to pray. And you pray that you enter not into temptation, because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So he tells them to sit, to wait, as we would say, to pray that they not enter into temptation. Then, Peter, James, and John, who are they? Well, there's been a lot of suggestions. We don't know why they were singled out. But we do know that, just like the song says, the disciple whom he loved, is that John the writer had in mind? I always wonder that. Do you mean John? Do you mean Peter? Because both of them, the description of the friendship, the close friendship he has, is described in the Gospels. And beyond that, there is James. And we know that these three, Peter, James, and John, are sort of the inner circle, are there sometimes described that way. It is several times that he takes these three, for example, the Mount of Transfiguration or other incidents. He takes the three. He separates them from the other nine. And he walks a little further, closer to this point where he's going to pray. So he separates them, and then he goes, as it says, about a stone's cast, about as far as you could throw a rock from them. And the Bible describes it different ways. And I put together several of these phrases out of the different accounts. Matthew tells us he began to be filled with sorrow, and notice the phrase, and deeply distressed. Now that's a word in particular that means and I don't think he's confused, but it's sometimes used that way, but your mind is scattered, is literally the idea. Your mind is running. Now, stop for a moment and think about it. You've just learned some terrible news. You've just realized a loved one has passed away. Doesn't your mind do that? Doesn't it begin to run in all different directions? Memories, worry, what's it going to be like? I can't live without. Or, what am I going to have to go through? What is this thing that's just been told me? What's it going to be like? What will it mean? What are the consequences of it? That's the idea here. He was deeply distressed. His mind, and for someone with a divine mind, what would that mean? The capacity of the mind of Jesus. He was astonished. I find that of all the descriptions, almost the most astonishing or amazing. How can God be astonished? How can anything? You know what astonished means? You're in awe. You're surprised. Wow! That kind of idea. How can God be like that? God knows everything. God understands everything. Yes, but God is now human. And this is what it means for a human to face something like this. He has never, even as God, faced death and the horror of this suffering. He understands it. It's going to happen. He knows what is going to happen. But emotionally, he's never faced it. Now he's facing it. He's astonished and he's full of heaviness, Mark tells us. He tells the three, I'm exceedingly sad. And notice what he says here. I'm exceedingly sad even to death. Do you ever use a phrase when you're going through something? Do you ever say something like, this is killing me? And you know that it's not literally killing you. But you know that the weight of it, the strength of the sorrow or whatever it might be that you're going through, if it's not eased, if it doesn't pass, you can't live with it. You ever felt a smothering feeling where literally, and I'm not talking about figuratively, but literally, because of the emotions, you can't breathe. You just literally, your mind will not order your lungs to take in a breath. You have to calm down, and that's what a lot of times friends are there for, to help you calm down, just so you can breathe. Jesus says to them, I'm exceedingly sad, even to death. I don't think they've ever seen him like this. I don't know that they know what to make of it. I do know that Scripture says when they went to sleep, their eyes were heavy for sorrow. I think it overwhelms them. They can't deal with seeing Jesus like this. I'm exceedingly sad, even to death. And he wanted them, at least Peter, James, and John, he wanted them to wait. And notice he says something different to them. And watch with me. What is he saying? Watch what? Watch what's going to happen? Watch me? Make sure I'm okay? Have you ever said that to anyone? Have you ever gone through anything that was so difficult that you said to somebody, keep an eye on me? Because it's really hard right now. You don't know what to expect. And you're saying to someone else, watch with me. Be there. You know, keep your eyes on me. Well, all of that is going on with Jesus. And Peter, and I'm borrowing from John 21, but I don't think this is far-fetched. You remember the exchange, and let me just digress for a moment. Remember the exchange when after Peter had denied, as Tom was talking about, after Jesus had looked on him, after he had wept bitterly. Jesus is resurrected from the dead, and none of that is ever resolved between Peter and Jesus. And you know what that's like. I mean, when something like that happens between friends, it's got to be resolved. Well, it hasn't been. But in John 21, it is. And when they had that exchange, remember that Jesus says to Peter, do you love me? And Jesus uses a term that means, Peter, will you sacrifice for me? Will you give for me? You didn't. You said you would, but you didn't. Now I'm asking you, do you have that committed love to me? Peter doesn't answer that. Oh, he was boastful before Jesus died. I'll die, I'll go to prison, I'll do all those things. But he doesn't answer him back, yes! No, he comes back and he says, Jesus, you know I love you. I'm your friend. Now, I don't think he's lying there. I think they are close friends. If I had to say, and I'm just going to give you Michael White's opinion, take it with a grain of salt, but this is what I see in the Gospels. Jesus is the closest to Peter and John. The Gospels say that, really. But I think with Peter, it is that best friend kind of relationship. And with John, it's like that little brother kind of relationship. That's why you see John at the Lord's Supper lying on Jesus. You know, in that day and time, you sit on the floor around a low table, and you kind of lean on each other's backs, you know, back to back and that kind of thing. But John is laying on his breast. He's laying on his chest. There's nothing homosexual about that at all. I have younger brothers, and I can remember when they were little. There's that very close brother-to-brother relationship. Peter says, you know I'm your friend. Jesus said, do you love me? Same question. Are you committed to me? Will you give everything for me? You know I'm your friend. And finally, then Jesus said, are you my friend? And that grieved Peter. Why? Because they were close friends. His very close friend is singled out right here. Peter, we're close friends, and I need you. And you know, when you go through those worst of times, you call on your closest friends. And you say, I need you. This is one of those times when I need you. There are times when you need me, and this is one of those times I need you. Peter, I need you. The Bible tells us he did go about as far as you throw a rock. What, 50, 60, some quarterbacks in the NFL, probably 100 yards. But he was separated. He went a good ways from them. But they could still see him, is the idea, clearly. And the Bible describes for us that he just fell face forward to the ground. Now I want you to look at this passage again in Luke 22. We're going to read some verses right here. Slow down a little bit and really look at this. But he fell face forward to the ground and he prayed to not go through the suffering. Look at some of the things that he says. If you're open to Luke, you can see this in these verses. But I've quoted it here for you. Now putting Matthew 26 and Luke 22 together, here's the full phrase. He said, oh my Father, if you are willing, if it is possible, remove this cup from me. Let it pass. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. You notice what he's saying. This is pleading with God the Father. If you're willing. Think of the closeness between the Father and Son. Think of going to your parent, or if you are a parent, your child coming to you and saying, if you're willing. I have no doubt that God the Father, separate and apart from what had to be done, if there were any way possible, would have wanted Jesus to not go through this. You'd have to be sadistic to want this to have to happen, but it has to happen. If you're willing, he is willing, in one sense, but it's not possible. Remove this cup from me. I can't remove it from you. Let it pass. It can't pass. And you know it. Nevertheless, not my will. And here he speaks, I think, in the sense of the executive will of God. Not my will, but yours. Thine be done. He was in intense agony. And you'll notice the Bible says that an angel came strengthening him in verse 43. And it's not over. Sometimes I hear people talk about this and say, you know, he prayed in the garden, and when it was over, when he had poured out his heart to God, God sent an angel to strengthen him. Well, that's not really correct. God sent the angel in the middle of it, if you look at Luke 22. He sent the angel to strengthen him in verse 43, and then verse 44, he continued. The Bible says, being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. Notice that. Have you ever been in a time when you prayed to God and you even know the answer is no? It's no. God will not override, for example, the choice of some person down here to sin that's affecting you. You're begging that it pass, but it can't, because a person has a free will and they choose to sin, and that hurts you. And that's exactly what's going on here. God cannot remove this because we sin. And Jesus has to go through it. Being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. How much more earnestly can you pray than falling face forward to the ground and begging something to pass? Well, the Bible tells you. He got so emotionally intense about this prayer that his sweat, great drops of sweat falling off of him, were so huge, so heavy, it was like blood. And there's a great difference, you know that. Sweat, when you're sweating, a little sweat trickles down your face and all of that kind of thing, kind of like a little tear, right? If you're bleeding and you bend over, I mean, huge drops fall off of you. Well, now, he's so intense, he's sweating so badly, it's like big drops of blood, not literally blood, but like big drops of blood falling off of him as he bows to the ground. And notice what he says, and Mark quotes this for us, Abba, Father. Edward led a song, Abba, Father, Father, if indeed it may, let this cup of anguish pass from me, I pray. We see that phrase in the New Testament, Abba, Father. Sometimes people will say it's redundant. Abba is that Aramaic term for Father, and Father is that Greek term for Father. Well, it's not redundant. And here's why. Abba signifies the emotional closeness you have with your Father. You know, when a person like my own dad, when I talk about my dad to someone else and I want to get them to respect him, you know, my dad, there are a lot of things that are very respectful about my dad. He's a man of honor. He is very honest. And I can commend him for that. I've seen him take personal, and I mean extreme personal losses, because he would not cheat someone else. I've seen that a couple of times in my life. Now, if I'm talking about my dad, I say my father. And I begin to talk about him, and I want you to respect him, and that is a term of respect. My father is an honest man. But when I see my dad, and there is that closeness that exists between us, that relationship, you know, that's there for all those years and so forth, to me, he's pops. And when I say pops to my dad, it's different than anybody else saying that, because he's my dad. That's Abba. Abba signifies he is my father. I am his child. That's my place, and that's Jesus' place. Abba, I don't want to go through this, Abba. I don't want to have to suffer this. I know this is what I've got to go through. I know I came to earth to do this, but I don't want to. That's the child pleading with the dad. Father, That's the term of respect. You sent me here. You prepared this human body for me. And both are there. Abba, Father, all things are possible to you. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, what I will, not what I will, but what you will. He continued to pray. And you'll notice that this incident, you may miss this if you don't carefully look at it, but this went on three different times. He kept coming back to the disciples. He kept finding them asleep for sorrow, as we mentioned earlier. Their eyes were heavy. He kept waking them up and saying, pray with me. He kept demonstrating to them how, and they could see it. Have you ever walked up on anyone going through something like this? It doesn't take you a half second to realize how messed up, as we say, someone is. They could see the sorrow in him. They could hear it in his voice. Don't know why that happened. Well, computer just died, and I don't know why. But anyway, I can finish the sermon. They could see it in him. They knew what was going on with him. They could tell it was horrible. But as you notice, as you read this, Jesus came back to them, and as he said, could you not watch with me? He singles out Peter, could you not watch with me 1 hour? You know, when people are the closest to you, you expect something from them. We're going to talk a little bit about that in tonight's sermon. We're going to talk about the relief. And you might find that strange. You might say there was no relief for Jesus. I want to suggest to you that some things are relief for Jesus throughout this whole incident. But this wasn't one of them. It should have been. The angel strengthening him should have been supplemented by his friends being there with him. They should have been there with him. They should have been praying with him. They should have been throwing their arms around him and saying, we're here with you. And as feeble as that might have been in the face of what he had to go through, they should have done it. There's certain things you should be able to expect in life. You know, a spouse ought to be able to expect love and honor and trustworthiness and so forth on the part of the other spouse. Your children should give you the respect. We were talking about it earlier. When I speak of my father, he is my father. He deserves a certain amount of honor. He deserves to be treated in a certain way. And I have a right to expect that if I'm a father, as he has a right to expect it. As a child, I should expect certain nurturing, certain care. I should be able to go to my Abba Father. And they ought to be an Abba Father. I should be able to expect those things. There are things in life we should be able to count on. And one of the things we should count on is friendship. You know, you can be friends in name. You can be pals that buddy around together and have fun together when everything is fun. And that's one kind of relationship. Or you can be real friends. So that if someone comes to you and says, I need you. This is one of those times, I need you. If you're going to call yourself a friend, you should be there. And Jesus, when he comes to Peter, James, and John, he says to them, I need you. When he finally singles out Peter, he says, couldn't you watch with me 1 hour? You are supposed to be the one that said a couple of hours ago, you go to prison for me. You die for me. And I told you, you won't do that. And as Tom read for us this morning, he won't. Not now. But what Jesus is saying to him in the garden is, man, you won't even stay awake 1 hour for me. What kind of friend is that? I think part of that is the look, Tom, that he gave to Peter, what, an hour later or whatever it might be. You're my friend, but you're not acting like my friend. And if I have to guess, looking at everything else in the New Testament, and I'll close with this, I think Peter spends the rest of his life proving he really is his friend. Jesus went through a lot of intense suffering. In the garden, we see the terrible emotional suffering. I'm going to stop there. If you're able to come back tonight, I'm going to pick up with that idea and go a little further, as I said. you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, if you believe in Jesus, that he came to earth to die for you, and you'll confess that belief. If this morning you're willing to change your life, live your life for him, and you'll be baptized to have your sins washed away, you will be his friend. That's what he calls you to be. You'll spend your life growing together with him, and your relationship will grow, and it will get stronger and closer so that one day, as friends, you can be together forevermore. Now, maybe you're here and you've done that, you've been baptized, but you look at your life and you say, I haven't shown my friendship to him. I haven't been the friend to Jesus that I need to be. Sometimes we sing a song, I'll be a friend. And just like Peter, you can turn things around today and start over again because he loves you and he will forgive you. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?